Hello and welcome to Talking Scared. I'm your host, Neil McRobert, and this week it's sisters doing it for themselves. Literally. Girl One is the second novel by Sarah Flannery Murphy, following on from the success of her debut, The Possessions. Now, this one's a change of tack entirely. It's a dark, wry, witty blend of horror, adventure, science fiction, and the road trip novel. And it posits the question of what it would mean for the world if women could conceive without the need of men. If that sounds like another book riding Margaret Atwood's coattails, trust me, it's not. Sarah's speculation is all her own. Girl One is a feminist dystopian nightmare, yes, and it has a lot to say about how men fear and therefore harm women. But it's also a joyful celebration of the female bond in all its forms. As I mentioned in our conversation, if Carrie had joined this group, she probably wouldn't have burned down the prom. Or maybe she would, but she'd have had a lot more fun doing it. Sarah and I talk about everything I've just mentioned and a lot more. Everything from Donald Trump to Kurt Cobain. But mostly, and appropriately, we keep it centred on women. And to cheaply quote a t-shirt slogan, "These are the daughters of the witches they couldn't burn." Briefly, if the audio is echoey again this week, then it's because I had to record in my kitchen because of the heat, but it is the last time. We are back on normal operating procedure now, aka my attic. But apologies if it sounds like Sarah and I were talking in a ballroom. Come with me through the highways and byways of America in search of a special community full of frightening, powerful women with zero time for your nonsense. Let's talk scared. Hi, Sarah, and a very warm welcome to Talking Scared.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me on.
I say very warm welcome as it's horrendously hot here in the UK. That's why my voice may be quite echoey, because I'm recording in the coolest room in my house. So if this is a bit of a weird audio, I apologise, but it's this or risk melting to death. I believe you're in the desert in Utah. Is that right?
That's right, yes. So we have been having temperatures of, you know, over 110 degrees Fahrenheit most days. It's been a little cooler lately, which means like only 100 degrees, which is for us like kind of a big deal in the summer.
Wow. I mean, we've been reading about heat domes and, you know, high pressure fronts and all that sort of stuff. And it does feel like the end of the world is kind of nigh, but I can't imagine what it must be like to be where you are right now. It must be like being living in the bottom of a frying pan.
It is. Yeah. You basically just have to live like a vampire. You don't really leave the house very much when the sun is out. You just kind of hide inside and like emerge into the shadows in the early morning or at the evening.
I mean, I suppose it's quite good for a writer. You have to sit at your desk and write all day.
Right. Yeah. It has been, I've been pretty productive over the summer. It is funny that people often think of summer as like a time when you're more active and more outdoors. And for me, it's kind of a hibernation. And then during the fall and winter, which are very mild here, that's actually when I'm able to go out into the world without like fearing melting on the spot.
Yeah. Me and some friends drove through the American desert once. I don't know, something like 15 years ago. And we drove through the Mojave and Death Valley and into Arizona and Utah. I remember getting to Death Valley, kind of like the hottest place on earth, and meeting the guy who ran sort of the visitor center. And I asked him where he was from, because he had an accent. And he said he was from Siberia. And I was like, how hot must you be?
Yeah, wow.
You've gone from something like minus 30 to, I think it was 50 degrees that day. Like it's a part of the world where no one should really be.
Yeah, that's surprising. I wonder like what kind of journey led him to becoming like a guide in Death Valley, which seems like a really intense job track.
Yeah, that's before I was a writer. I would have probably asked him all about it if I'd known.
Yeah.
But anyway, pointless segues aside, speaking of hot, and this is a hell of a segue, we're here to discuss your new novel. It's called Girl One. It came out in the US back in June. and it's out in the UK and various other territories in early August, I think the 5th of August, from Raven and Bloomsbury. It's getting much love from early readers, and, well, I'm delighted to talk to you about it, but what can you tell my listeners that they need to know about Girl One?
I think the most important thing to know is that it's an alternate history. In 1971, in the world of Girl One, a controversial scientist was able to induce parthenogenesis, otherwise known as virgin birth, in 9 human women. They were the subject of all kinds of fascination and controversy, these 9 baby girls who were born without any biological fathers, just genetic material from their mothers. Everything went belly up. There was a terrible tragedy in the late 70s, and all of the surviving mothers and daughters scattered across the U.S. to seek anonymity or otherwise normal lives. And the novel follows Girl One, the first girl born of this strange experiment, who is now in her 20s. She is attempting to follow in the footsteps of her lost sort of father figure, the scientist who oversaw the experiment. And when she learns that her mother is missing, she sets out initially just to find her mother and ends up being pulled into this aspect of her past that she had not been exposed to yet, and uncovering all kinds of dark secrets and strange truths about her own origin story.
Right. So how to start, how to contextualize this? Girl One, I would say, is closer to the speculative thriller end of the spectrum rather than the kind of the extremes of horror. But, you know, this show is called Talking Scared rather than Talking Horror for a reason. And there's still plenty of darkness within this book. Now, I don't want to just focus on those nastier aspects, because there's lots of interesting stuff to discuss as well as that. But it is a good place to start. So I think if you tell me, what is the heart of darkness in Girl One to you?
Ooh, that's a good question. I really came to it thinking a lot about how for women or for people who have a uterus, that pregnancy and giving birth can be a wonderful power if you choose it for yourself. But it has so often been made instead into a liability, a danger, a way to hold people back. And I was really curious to explore that through the lens of a slightly more kind of exaggerated sci-fi, almost like superhero take. But I think it really grew from sort of my, I feel like a sort of lifelong interest in noticing how pregnancy and birth are this double-edged sword. I'm very interested by the way that it's presented in a kind of delicate, gentle light, and the actual act of it can be very fraught and like very physical, and it does carry physical risks. And then I think there are all these other risks and liabilities that are added on completely unnecessarily in ways that I think can just end up being very dangerous or restricting women's or, you know, people who are giving birth, restricting their lives in all kinds of ways. So for me, I think that's the core of darkness that I was exploring there.
Yeah, it's something I hadn't thought about, actually, the actual physicality of giving birth in this novel, because that all kind of happens off page, so to speak.
Yeah.
And it's a lot more about the social and political kind of after effects of taking men out of the equation, I suppose.
Yeah.
When did you start writing it?
I actually had the idea for this novel quite a long time ago. I would say easily, like, oh man, like I was going to say 10 years, but then I remembered how old I am and I'm like, oh no, it was longer than 10 years. Probably at least 10 years before I started officially writing it. But I only really started writing the recognizable draft, like where if you picked it up and read it, you would kind of be able to tell where I was going with it versus like the drafts I've written that are unrecognizable. Probably in, I feel like it was in the summer or maybe like at the beginning of 2017. Because I remember like I was pregnant myself that year with my second son. And when I was like, I remember giving birth to him in like July, and I was almost like, oh, like it's nice to have this reason to take a break from thinking about this draft because it was giving me some trouble at that point. So yeah, I would say early 2017 is when I really was like diving into it and, you know, talking about it with my agent and like really committing to it.
Okay. The reason I asked that is because I immediately wondered how much the novel was influenced or reflecting recent social political realities. Do you know what I mean? Because there are elements of this story that are a feminist nightmare, and there are elements of life that have been a feminist nightmare in recent years. You know, the big orange baby in the room that we're all talking about. And I wonder how much of that was the kind of driving influence behind what you were writing. Were you responding to that, do you think?
I think I definitely was responding to it. And I know that these past few years have been particularly difficult in that sense. I was raised in a very, at the time, my family was Catholic. And I was raised in a kind of culture where abortion and reproductive issues were talked about quite frequently. I actually kind of grew up knowing people who were like anti-abortion protesters. And so it was like, I feel like that was just a part of my mental landscape, I guess, a bit earlier than some people. Like my older son right now is like 8 years old. And, you know, we've had basic birds and bees talks with him and have kind of talked very generally about some aspects of like reproduction and how it affects women in particular. But like, the world in which I grew up, where people, where like adults that I trusted would just talk about it a lot in like a lot of detail and just focus so heavily on it. I think it was just kind of always on my radar. And I've also lived in red states in the US, which has always made me like a little bit of a political outsider in them. Like, for example, I was born in Arkansas, which does not really have the greatest track record of progressive issues. So I think I've always seen like these horrifically restrictive anti-abortion laws passing, and it's just always been this really, really heated topic of conversation. So I think it's always kind of been at the forefront of my mind in a certain way, even from the time I was pretty young and maybe not quite as able to process some of it.
Okay. It just feels like it's impossible these days to have a conversation about women's rights or really anyone's rights without looking at the last sort of 4 or 5 years and just going, Jesus Christ, how have we got here again?
Yeah.
And this book is particularly interesting in that regard because it's not set in the contemporary day. It's set in the 90s. And it's quite interesting to see how much opinions haven't changed, particularly male opinions, how they haven't changed in the intervening, I don't know, 25 years. That's quite a sickening thing, you know. But I do wonder, why did you set it in the past, first of all? Was it because you mentioned it's an alternative history? Why make it that? Why not make it a contemporary story?
I really felt like setting it in the 1970s. I've always been very drawn to the 1970s, and I feel like it was a time, it felt like a time where something like this would be possible in a certain way. You know, there were so many back to the land movements, and I feel like people were rethinking a lot of structures and just kind of moving away from the patterns and rhythms of life that they had known at that time. And I also think there was a genuine interest, very niche, and like something that I was very surprised to stumble across. But I did find out that there were some smaller groups of people who were interested in parthenogenesis, that like the possibility of reproducing without like a biological, without a genetic father, was something people were really looking at and thinking, like, you know what, this could happen. And when I found out about that, it really validated my decision to set it in the 1970s, because I just, yeah, to me, it just, I know that this is a slightly odd answer, but like, it just felt very right. Like, it felt like it needed to be in the 70s. And then shifting ahead to the 90s, I mean, that is when Josie would have been in her early 20s, which felt like about the right time for her to start looking into her past, you know, like just this kind of verge where you're still able to see like your young, like your childhood or teenage years sort of in the rear view mirror, but like you're very much moving into adulthood and are already there and are sort of figuring yourself out and trying to balance those different sides of yourself. So it felt right for her to be in her 20s in this story. And also, honestly, I feel like setting it in the 90s was quite helpful because from a logistical standpoint, it let her do a lot more legwork and like a lot more detective work. I guess that was like 94, which feels like maybe not the last time, but it feels like after that, like, more technology would have crept into people's lives. And that was kind of the best time to set it for her to be able to like go out on this road trip and not just like look things up. You know, she had to kind of put in this certain amount of legwork.
That's interesting because, yeah, it does feel a little bit like the internet has ruined any kind of quest fiction now, because you walk to your desk and the entire universe is there for you. And people go to extraordinary lengths to get people off grid and away from digital avenues. So I think, yeah, probably putting it back in time makes things easier. And also, I'm a sucker for anything with 90s period detail, because obviously it's like pure nostalgia for me. I think we're roughly the same age.
I think so.
I kept smiling at how often you mentioned Kurt Cobain and Nirvana. Are you a fan?
I am. And also, I feel like when I was looking up events that would have happened right in April of 1994, and I feel, you know, that Cobain's death would have been like a very, it would have been a very prominent event back then, you know, that people would be talking about and thinking about. So I was just trying to make sure that like what they heard on the radio would have been authentic to what people really might have heard, even though this like alternate history I created was very much like alternate. Like, I did want it to feel pretty grounded and rooted.
You weren't going with the Tarantino thing of like saving Sharon Tate's life then? You didn't think you'd just save poor Kurt from his untimely death?
I could have done that. That's actually a really good point. That would have taken the book in a very different direction. But yeah, now that you pointed out, I guess I could have changed a few more historical details while I was at it. Kind of an oversight.
There are no nice men in this book. Cobain could have been the one decent guy. Although to be fair, yeah. Dave Grohl's the better guy anyway. Let's change tack. A simple question, but one I kept coming back to throughout, really. Is Girl One a tale of witches and witchcraft?
I see it that way. I know that there's a conversation that touches on this that's fairly deep into the book, where one of the girls, Kate, I guess it's not really a spoiler, so I can admit who it was, is kind of hypothesizing about like how, or I guess it's actually Josie who says that. Now I'm like, wait, I'm completely misremembering my own character's conversation. But they hypothesize about how, you know, this experiment might not have been as groundbreaking as people think, and that it could have just brought it more to the surface in a visible way. And before this, there could have been so many instances of parthenogenesis that were just completely kept hidden because, you know, I feel like being a single mother could be, it has been a very difficult undertaking throughout much of history. And, if, you know, admitting that you have a child with no biological father, I think that would definitely make some waves and definitely cause some uproar. So yeah, I really wanted to play with that idea that what we're seeing happening in Girl One is the most visible and perhaps has the most attention because it's been organized under this veneer of science that makes it somewhat more acceptable to people, but that this is like one point in a long secret ongoing history that would very much play into different myths of witches and monsters. And, you know, they kind of ask in the book, like how all these myths kind of occurred and like, wouldn't there be something a little bit behind them? And maybe this was it, if there have been people throughout history who do have these strange powers and supernatural abilities. So yeah, I did very much want to tie it into the idea of witchcraft. And that's touched on a little more explicitly in some scenes where they're literally accused of being witches. And that term is like brought very, very kind of explosively to the forefront.
Well, yeah, it's like I said, in that things don't change. So you look at the 90s and nothing has changed between then and now. And then you go back all the way to Salem. Do you know what I mean? And there are girls in this world who may have certain abilities that set them as outsiders, and the patriarchy wants to punish them for it. For me, that's the horror, that these things never change. And I mean, you mentioned before that this is in many ways a superhero novel, and I've seen you reference in other articles online the fact that some of these girls have sort of wild abilities in some way, and we won't go into it too much.
Yeah.
But it put me in mind throughout, actually, about Stephen King's Carrie, to tie this back into horror, that kind of outsider with an ability would fit into this novel very well. But the difference between Carrie and your heroes or heroines is that Carrie was alone and was ostracized by her community and by the sisterhood. And look what happened, you know. Whereas your characters are grouped, and there are bonds, and it's a more positive representation of what women can do when they cooperate.
Yeah, that's a wonderful point about Carrie. Yeah, about Firestarter. I mean, that story, I love that story. And it's very, like, it's so iconic and like so visually, just like, when I think of horror, like thinking of her standing there with like the blood dripping down her, you know, it's an amazing kind of visual image. It is, I find it a very, like it's a heartbreaking story too, especially because like her relationship with her mother is so, I mean, to say it's terrible, it's like, it sounds like a joke because it's such an understatement. She definitely does not have a positive, healthy relationship with her mother at all. And that, like, I think that really broke my heart, you know, that like she could have perhaps with guidance and love, or any kind of acceptance, like she could have turned that into more of a power for good, or if not for good, at least been able to explore it on her own terms versus it being like such an act of like just pain and revenge. Yeah. So the mother-daughter relationship in that story, I definitely was trying to depict a still very complicated relationship between mothers and daughters, because I'm not sure that any other kind exists out there, but one that is able to come to a better place and the two of them able to see each other more clearly.
Indeed. I mean, because the story in many ways is about Josephine and her mother. Before we get to that, actually, as I just said before about, you know, your book is about these outsider women who actually find bonds and they find friendship and sisterhood. And amongst all the darkness, Girl One is a really kind of positive, empowering story about female, you know, relationships of all different kinds, so like maternal, familial, friends, lovers, sisters in some regards. It's really positive. Did you feel like you were writing in some ways a corrective to the way that women are often written about?
Definitely. I thought about that a lot. I feel like people can paint the bonds between women in a really, really negative way. And I don't want to pretend like, you know, that every woman has an automatic connection with every other woman. I mean, you know, women can be quite terrible to each other, of course, as any human can be. And I know that there are also intersectional issues, you know, where, for example, like white women can be incredibly cruel and oppressive towards women of color. I mean, there are all kinds of different dynamics going on that I don't want to paint it in a light as if women are automatically more capable of caring for each other. But I do feel like there is sort of there's like a little bit of an unfairly negative light tossed on women and their friendships and their bonds in general. I feel like, for one thing, in a lot of narratives, you often just have one woman like kind of at the edge of a group of men. So, you know, I mean, it's like the Bechdel test. It's like, do you even have two named women who are able to have like a conversation with each other and able to speak to each other and see each other in complex ways? Or are they mostly just sort of sprinkled throughout pockets of men who get to have interesting, complex relationships with each other, but the women are sort of like the little like satellites out there, you know, and not quite getting to be on screen or on the page together? And people have said, you know, I remember reading some terrible quote that really stung, that it was something about how, like, well, why would women ever expect men to respect them when, like, women don't even like each other? And I was like, oh man, like that is a lot to unpack, and I fully do not agree with that. But I think there's just this like not like other girls stereotype. There's this idea that like women don't want to be friends with each other because it will just be dramatic and petty and backstabbing, and you know, it's easier to be friends with men. And I think that women can be pitted against each other quite a lot in ways that feel very alienating. And of course, I take full responsibility for any ways in which I've thought that over the years, you know, and in which I've been too nervous to like approach other women, or I see a group of women and assume, you know, that it would be difficult to join their friend group, you know, and a lot of it can be a little bit protective or defensive. But I did want to really question that and really question whether or not that's like an accurate view. And I mean, that's why I wanted Josie in particular to kind of get to explore that throughout the novel, like where she kind of starts wondering, like, you know, she actually goes back and like looks at some of her earlier interactions with other characters and things like, oh, was I underestimating her? Was I being too harsh on her? Was I being too sanctimonious? Just to kind of show the ways that I think women can hear these messages about how they are, you know, about how they're backstabbing or they have trouble bonding with other women and kind of internalize it to a certain extent. And then at a certain point, you have to say, wait a second, like, this doesn't really reflect my reality. Like, this doesn't seem true. And you have to question it and kind of unroot it in yourself as well.
Yeah, that's very interesting. I had a very similar conversation with Rachel Harrison about her book, The Return.
Oh, I love that. Yeah.
Well, yeah, there you go. It's an excellent, for me, I mean, from my outsider perspective, depiction of a quite authentic female friendship group.
Yeah.
And I had a very similar conversation, and not to retread the same ground because they're very different books. But again, just like you said, just like Rachel said, I think culture only ever depicts women in competition with each other, or in a very, very, very twee and saccharine idea of what a supportive relationship is. It's rare that you get something that is raw and authentic, in the way that my wife and her friends are, you know, for example.
Yeah.
They argue, they fall out, but none of it's competitive.
Yeah.
At all. It's as supportive as my friends are to me. And it's always refreshing when you get a book that gives the opportunity to depict authentic female group dynamics, because it's quite rare in genre fiction, I think. Even though genre fiction is still driven, like you said, by the group of men and the one woman who is not like other women, the Ellen Ripley type on the fringes. And I liked a lot of the incidental scenes in this of just conversation between sort of Joe and Kate and Isabel and stuff like that. I liked a lot of that as much as the high octane thriller stuff.
Oh, that's wonderful. I mean, those scenes were really, really fun to write. It was really wonderful to be able to explore their dynamic and to see Josie, who at first is a little bit just so driven on like finding her mother and kind of getting back to what she considers her real life. And then she starts to realize that like these people that she's met and connected with and shares this really powerful history with can actually be like support, and she in turn can support them. I really enjoyed writing their trio and kind of letting them bounce off each other a little bit.
And it's really interesting. I'm glad you mentioned the Bechdel test. So for those who don't know, I think I got this right. Alison Bechdel came up with this theory that so many films fail what has since been called the Bechdel test, which is that am I right about this? It's two women having a conversation that's not about a man.
Yeah, I think sometimes people say that they need to have names as well, but I think that's a little bit in question, or that's like a more minor part of it, but that's like the core of it.
So two significant characters having a conversation that's not about a man, which sounds ridiculous, but it's amazing how many books and films don't pass that very simple test.
Yeah.
And I was actually weirdly thinking about that when reading your book, because as much as your book does pass that test, what's really interesting, and it's a bit of a paradoxical one, this, because your book is about how men no longer need to be the center of the universe, because we've achieved parthenogenesis. Women can self-conceive. Women are self-sufficient. Women, you know, have these bonds which are supportive. It's a world in which men are not necessary, which then prompts a lot of the pushback from men and thus the horror and the action of the novel. But all that said, there is still at the heart of this novel a male figure that again and again and again becomes the focus of the story, or the focus of the women's attentions. So quite in a weird way, the extent to which this book on occasion fails the Bechdel test kind of backs up your point. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I know. I've thought about that a lot too. You know, it was difficult to figure out how to approach it. And I think having Josie be so fixated on Dr. Bellinger, it did end up putting the focus on him from a narrative perspective so much as well, which sometimes feels a little bad, or I'm like, maybe, you know, I could have pulled back a bit from that. I think, like I said, I just wanted so much to focus on the story of her kind of realizing how much faith she has poured into him, and how she's seen him in this certain light. And like, by focusing so primarily on him, she's overlooked all these other, you know, all these other women who were a very significant part of this story. But you're right, it is kind of a weird, like, the issue with that, like the paradox of that is that, like, then I do end up talking about him quite a lot through Josie's perspective.
It's kind of an unavoidable tension buried within the narrative, isn't it? Which, I mean, it works because eventually it's about Josie fighting her way free of that, I suppose. So it's not that it's a weakness. It's just that it's a book that's sort of pulling against its own point in a way.
Yeah, I like that. Yeah. I'm glad that it was something that worked for you, and that like contributed to the tension of the story, because that was definitely my intention.
Her obsession with Dr. Bellinger, who, so just in case we've wandered too far away from, you know, people's understanding, Dr. Bellinger is the person who achieved this scientific miracle in these nine women. One of whom is Josie's mother. So that's the dynamic. So he is a kind of de facto father. And that theme of whether he is a father, whether he's not, is kind of an underlying theme of the novel. But it dawned on me towards the end, because obviously she's her mother's gone missing. She's trying to track her mother down. And at the start of the novel, she has very, very a complex, fraught relationship with her mother, and nothing but admiration for her dead father figure. And for me, the entire novel reads as kind of an elaborate Electra complex, where this young woman goes on a journey away from a fixation on the father towards a kind of newfound identification with the mother. And then obviously that with Electra pulls back into myth and all those things you were talking about. It feels like Freud is everywhere in this story.
Yeah, I hadn't thought of that. But yeah, I mean, it was really important for me to kind of have her have these new realizations about her mother, especially because I feel like the difference between like how fathers and mothers are portrayed in fiction can feel a little bit glaring to me sometimes. I feel like fathers can be these, you know, even if they aren't there on the scene, even if they aren't like especially good parents, even, I suppose, they still are like these kind of larger than life, fascinating, eccentric, like weird characters. And I feel like mothers often have to be the sort of ones who are, you know, kind of telling people not to put themselves in danger as they like sneak out and have adventures, you know. And I feel like for Josie, Margaret ended up being this figure who was like somebody to basically grow beyond. Like, oh, she was someone who was kind of important in my youth, but like now I'm just gonna like let her be in the background. And she has to come to realize like how multifaceted her mother was, and like how complex she really was, and how she had a much bigger role than Josie ever thought in the like origin story that fascinates Josie so much.
And I'm sure it is an accident and means nothing, but it did make me smile that Margaret, Josie's mother, has the same name as Carrie's mum.
That is a total accident. I didn't even remember that at all. Like, I'm bad with character names. Like, I remember the main ones, but like after I read so many books, sometimes they fly out of my head. So that's actually That's actually amazing. I'm glad you said that because I did not know.
It's everything you just said then ties into another way to kind of read this novel. In some ways, it's kind of an abuse narrative. In, you know, Josie grows to understand that she's been mistreated by her father, de facto father, whatever. And she becomes more accepting of her mother's behaviour as a fellow victim, really. And it struck me that right at the start of this, I asked you where the darkness was in this novel. And you gave a really interesting answer about birth and the pressures and the dangers. But there is also a much more literal darkness, that there is abuse everywhere in this novel, isn't it? Isn't there? You know, from microaggressions all the way to rape and murder. And it gets really, really dark about the sexual politics between men and women in, I mean, I know it's the 90s, but essentially contemporary life.
That is a really good point. I feel like my instinctive answer kind of comes from a place of, sometimes I feel like I kind of see my novels from like this perspective that brings in like what I originally wanted to do and what originally sparked the idea. And it was reproduction that initially sparked the idea. But of course, the narrative kind of grew into its own thing as well. And you're right that we follow the girls who, you know, I wanted to portray some women in the narrative who were not interested in becoming mothers, or at least not interested in becoming mothers right then. You know, childbirth really, or becoming a mother, is not like heavy on, or not really part of Josie's view of herself and not something at the top of her mind. So yeah, when we follow the girls, we run into, we run into these moments where they fully realize like the repercussions of what their births have stirred up, and like the anxieties and the fears and like violence that has created. And yeah, there are plenty of scenes, but like there's a scene in the middle, kind of in the middle of the book, where while trying to track down some of the mothers, a certain mother-daughter pair, Josie and Kate and Isabel, end up finding evidence of something truly, you know, horrific having taken place. And that, yeah, I think that's a moment when Josie's eyes are really, really opened to just how deep this fear and hatred of what she represents can go.
Yeah, the men from Kythera. I mean, yeah. It even sounds creepy saying that out loud. I mean, I must admit it, it was my favourite part of the book. I mean, that's because I'm quite twisted. Because at that point, it suddenly feels like the entire pitch of the book has swerved towards out-and-out horror. It's a kind of nested horror subplot within a wider supernatural tale.
Before that, I feel like when they had approached the people from Josie's past, you know, there had been certainly some strange moments and some weird revelations, but up until then, most of them had been fairly, I don't want to say normal, but I guess like they were able to visit them and talk to them and move on in a pretty normal way. And I wanted this stop to be one that at first seemed like it would just be very similar to the others. And you know, you just knock on the door, like get what information you can, like maybe there's something kind of bizarre happening, as there have been at a few of the others, but you're able to move on. And this one, you know, nearly puts a stop to the entire journey. Like it just really, really makes them realize the stakes and realize what they've found, you know, that by uncovering her true origin story and by looking into the lives of these women that Josie has not reconnected with and not really looked up for so long, she's finding a lot of wonderful things and a lot of connection, but she's also finding this darkness that she had kind of not been exposed to yet, or had closed her eyes to a little bit.
Mm. Yeah, that's at the extreme end of the spectrum. But like I said, it feels like violence in all its forms, like are built into the fabric of this world. The letters that Dr. Bellinger writes to Joseph, you know, they're so chauvinistic. They're so gender specific. You know, they tell her she's a little girl. They put her in her place. And the interviews he gives her are the same about the women that he works with. But there's one moment, and this is, you might laugh at this because it's such a trivial moment, but there's one moment in the book that I thought was really, really powerful, and it really, really struck home, perhaps because I can put myself in the antagonist's shoes with this one. So Josie is talking to her friend, Kate, one of the other daughters, who is gay. And they're talking about, you know, Kate is openly gay, comfortable with it. And Josie is saying that, you know, she knew one gay girl at school. And I'm going to paraphrase this slightly to condense it. But she says, Lacey, that was her name. One time she told me how much she liked my backpack. And a square-jawed kid started stage whispering, Man-Haters Club, until Lacey and I had wordlessly gone to opposite sides of the cafeteria. And for me, as small a moment as that is, it stands for the entire novel, because it's about the fact that men are terrified of women being united and just do whatever they can to divide them. And it works.
Yeah, that was, I'm glad that that moment stuck out, you know, because there are so many supernatural elements in the book, and there are, you know, scenes that are very action-packed, or just, at least I was hoping to make them very thrilling or kind of larger than life. But I also wanted to touch on like little intimate, relatable moments from Josie's life, you know, like these small moments that she might not have necessarily mulled over or thought about until talking with Kate brings it up again, where she remembers these like small and, you know, ultimately like not super impactful moments that actually do kind of get beneath the skin and like have shaped her view of herself and you know, and successfully made sure that, yeah, that she didn't get to know this girl. And perhaps if she had, like, they might have had, you know, a stronger connection, and Josie might have learned a bit more about herself at an earlier age.
I just found it a really sad moment. And I think I found it so horrifying because I could imagine myself at 15, before I, you know, got a brain and grew up, I could imagine myself or one of my friends at school saying something similar if a girl we liked had dismissed us. You know, I think it's built into the culture in a way that's, I mean, hopefully things are different these days. I think they probably are. But yeah, it really spoke to me that moment as really standing, as I say, for the whole novel about men dividing women and how, because they're terrified of them, basically. And I've got to say, what I found interesting, or what I found quite a bold storytelling choice, is that men are almost universally enemies in this novel, whether in an individual or a broader sense. And I think that's great, because I don't like books that pull their punches. But I do wonder, have you had any pushback on that from either from editors or from early readers? Because I can imagine some kind of bros getting their knickers right in a twist.
You know, I haven't had that much pushback on it, which I've been happy about. There are definitely, you know, I mean, any book, like this is my second book coming out into the world. And there are people who have all kinds of critiques and elements of it that they didn't love, which I absolutely understand. I mean, I can't lie and say that it feels good as an author, but I'm a huge reader. I was a reader long before I was an author. And I do know, you know, I am sympathetic to what it's like to read a book and like love it mostly, but not love that, or maybe not love it at all. And I always welcome people's right to talk about that. I'm not always sure that I like overhearing it, but I'm glad that people can talk about it and bring new perspectives to it. In terms specifically of male characters not being sympathetic, to be totally honest, I find one of them, like, I didn't want him to be entirely unsympathetic, you know? Talking, of course, about Tom, like, I do realize that Tom has moments of being very flawed, and there are some pretty huge flaws that come into play, perhaps a little bit later in the book that I won't touch on specifically. But ultimately, to be honest, as an author, I kind of like Tom. I think he's a very flawed person, but I don't think he's necessarily even more flawed than, for example, like Josie herself, who I didn't want to be a flawless character. She's arrogant. She actually can be quite sexist in her attitudes towards other women. Tom, he despite his flaws, I do think he has good aspects to him, and I don't know if that always comes across. But in my head, I wanted him to be someone who is like flawed and yet like a depiction of someone who can get better and who can try harder.
Completely agree with you. Tom is not a villain in any real sense of the word, but what I did like is the fact that you, essentially he becomes an irrelevance to the plot.
Yeah.
And I just really enjoyed that, because I was almost kind of like cheering you on, saying, you know, please don't give in and don't give us like a male character to salve the egos of the men who will get annoyed that you haven't. Do you know what I mean? I was like, just go for it. And I was quite glad that at the end, men are either dicks or irrelevant in this story. I'm glad you stuck the landing, so to speak.
Well, that's really nice to hear.
The one thing I will say to any listeners is, if you like horror, then horror has been full of Path to Genesis over the years, because, you know, Frankenstein, Jekyll and Hyde, even Dracula, all of those characters are driven by the desire to essentially create life asexually, or at least without the involvement of women, you know?
Yeah.
You know, the history of horror is littered with male self-conception, and it's nice and good and interesting to read a story from the other side, because there aren't enough of them.
Yeah, I mean, that's really interesting the way you said that, like male self-conception. Yeah, and I think that Bellinger, in a way, was attempting to do that as well, And this story is sort of the women themselves, like, asserting the fact that they were not just vessels for his work, but were actually, like, the most important part of it.
It's a great corrective to the mad scientists of horror history, really. It's a new take on something as old as horror itself. What's next for you, Sarah? You mentioned you've been quite busy over the summer and quite productive.
I have been busy. I don't know if I would necessarily say productive. No, I have been productive. It's just I've been writing quite a lot, trying to get to a solid first draft of my third book, which is very, very exciting. And sometimes I think that forcing myself to write quite a lot on it is really the only way through, you know, because otherwise if I like give myself a little extra time or a lower word count, like I might find reasons to not write. But it's a book that I really, really, really love. It's set in the Arkansas Ozarks, where I lived as a teenager. And it's a place that I consider quite spooky and kind of mystical and strange. So setting a book there has been it's been like a lot of fun. You know, I have a lot of books about the Ozarks, and I've been able to like draw on my own memories and experiences too. So it's been a lot of fun.
I really want to visit the Ozarks. Because I've watched Ozark and I've read Winter's Bone. And so essentially, you know, I've read all of the cliched things that have introduced me to the Ozarks. But I'm desperate to go there, because it feels like a genuinely spooky place.
It very much is. Like, I remember seeing somebody online talking about, like, going to Arkansas and talking about what a creepy place it was, like, just how it had, like, a weird vibe or something. And I was like, well, that's not true, you know, because I lived there and I do have a more thorough understanding of it. And I think it has, like, I mean, it's an incredibly beautiful natural landscape. Like, it's literally nicknamed the natural state. It's just gorgeous. But like, when I think about it, I'm like, oh, okay. Like, there is like a little bit of something just kind of eerie around the edges, which I like. So maybe that's why I was all defensive at first. Like, what are you talking about? But yeah, I can see it.
Yeah. Eerie is good. Listen, yeah. speaking of good, before we end up, could you recommend a book for my listeners and say why you're recommending it?
Of course. The book I'm going to recommend is called Mary Lou is Everywhere by Sarah Elaine Smith. It's not really horror, but it has like a very eerie tone to it and a kind of spooky premise, because it's about a teenage girl who goes missing, and through the narrator's eyes, we follow her as she sort of steps into the place of this missing girl in her traumatized mother's life. And that sounds quite dark and grim, but I think Smith writes with like a really lovely sense of humor. She just captures like this teenage voice in a way that's very smart to me. And I think it's set in Pennsylvania, but even growing up in Arkansas, there were some of the people that kind of populate this book that are a little more rural, or come from like more rural areas. They felt so authentic to me and like presented with like compassion. And I just think it's such a compelling, like very unique book with a great voice.
And what's the title again?
It's Mary Lou is Everywhere. Just the name Mary Lou, like Mariloo.
By Sarah Elaine Smith. I will stick it in the show notes. Thank you. That sounds great. And lastly, Sarah, what truly scares you?
Oh, there are so many things. I feel like I'm a very fearful person, so it's almost easier to ask what doesn't scare me. Right now I'm going to go with doppelgangers. Like, doppelgangers have just been on my mind lately. I am not sure why exactly. I wish I could unpack it and understand it. Just the idea of like seeing myself walk by, or the idea of like encountering somebody close to me and then like, you know, walking into another room and finding them there. Like, that sense of just the uncanniness of it. And like, yeah, I get quite upset even thinking about it. And I was reading a lot about doppelgangers recently, which is not healthy for me because I've been afraid of them my whole life. And my son, who is 8, was talking about like designing a video game that's like a version of our house that we really live in with like alternate versions of us. And he was like, oh yeah, there's like this one that's called the Smiling Writer, and like she wears like all black, and like she lives in like the bedroom closet, and she's just like always smiling at you. And I was like, oh, this is like the worst time for you to bring this up, because I was just reading this thread online about doppelgangers, and somebody was like, isn't it interesting that they always live in closets? And then like my kid says this, and I'm like, oh, I have to, you know, I have to stop reading about doppelgangers for a little bit.
Right. A few things to pick up on that. One, your kid's clearly a genius. Get him writing immediately. Two, normally, when I ask that question, sometimes people answer with something incredibly downbeat by saying something like, you know, my children dying or something. So it's always great fun when people say something like doppelgangers that you don't expect. Yeah. So thank you for that. And three, have you seen Coraline?
Yes. I mean, I love it. Yeah. Every Halloween we like have it playing, you know, every other day basically. It's so wonderful.
Because it does sound a little bit like, you know, the smiling writer, like the yes. other mother, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. Ooh, yeah, and that's... the last thing I'll say is you have just yeah. written a book in which women give birth to children who look exactly like them. So it feels I like know. There's a whole lot of neurosis to unpick there for you.
Yeah, I will have to take some time to sort through that.
Yeah, well, I will leave you to do it. And all I can say is really enjoyed the book. As I say, it's a really nice twist on a topic. And I wish you all the best with it in the UK. When it comes out August 5th. But for now, Sarah Flannery Murphy, thank you for talking scared.
Thank you so much. It's been a wonderful conversation.
So I forgot to mention it in the intro, but can you believe it? Talking Scared has hit the half century. 50 episodes, which is frankly madness. I remember starting this show back last September with Paul Tremblay and John Langan and Joe Kaplan, and wow, it's been a long year and a long pandemic. But yeah, 50 episodes. Never imagined getting here. Some fantastic friends made, a growing listenership, well over 10,000 downloads, a sponsor soon to be announced, watch this space, and I even understand the rudiments of Audacity now. I won't get too effusive. After all, the 1 year birthday is only a few episodes away, and I'll wax lyrical then. But yeah, I've got to say, it's been so much fun, and I'm incredibly grateful. Girl One was a weirdly fitting way to round out the 50. It's a quirky book that's full of angst and politics and meaty stuff that I interpreted, but which probably isn't there anyway. It's not even really a horror book. Instead, it's a genre-blending mix of all kinds of dark things. In short, it's exactly the kind of novel that fits in so well on this odd little podcast. I always like it when a guest says that I made them think new things about their book. It means I've done my job properly. But I also love it when a book makes me think new things about the world, or even about myself, and this one did. Like I said, it made me realise how dangerous the idea of a united womanhood seems to some men, and what they will do and are doing to prevent it. That's not news to at least half of you, I know, but this book, more than most, puts it into stark perspective. It's a teaching novel that doesn't preach or even yell, but it slowly stirs things to the surface. On top of that, of course, it's pacey, and it has that hellish little horror side plot in the middle, The Men from Kythera, and a lot of you will really like it. Of course, let me know if you do. Lots and lots of you have started emailing me now to talk books, and I'm thrilled. Keep it up, please. Email me at talkingscaredpod@gmail.com or find me on Twitter @talkscaredpod. I'm always ready for a chat about books or your favourite serial killer or the stories of your haunted hometown. If you want to see pictures of books and my increasing gallery of spooky ruins that I stumble across on my daily dog walk, then it's probably Talking Scared Pod on Instagram that you want. And I am making more of an effort there each week. I even did a reel recently, which was a culture shock. The more I use social media, the more I realise I'm a man basically born to work in a library, ideally wearing a corduroy jacket. That said, I am embracing all avenues of the digital world. TikTok seems to be impending, and you can sign up to Patreon for extra bonus content. Just a few dollars gets you at least 2 extra episodes per month, including my recent chat about extreme horror with the Queen of Extreme, Zobo with a Shotgun. Next week you'll get the latest extra chat from Grady Hendrix, Chuck Wendig and Ronald Malfi. And you can sign up via the show notes or on patreon.com/talkingscaredpod. Oh, and a big hello and welcome to Bernadette Kane, the most recent subscriber. May your nights be pleasantly haunted, Bernadette, and thank you. All this user-listener integration gets even realer next week when I'll be launching my new collaboration. I'm excited to bring you that as it will help your reading experience and let us chat more easily about the books that we love. And that episode will also feature none other than the cult king of horror fiction himself, Brian Evanson, who is much sunnier of disposition than his fiction would have you believe. But until then, keep an eye on the road, your hands in your pockets, and your misogyny to yourself. Read good books, and remember, it's good to be scared.